This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. It's Friday. Time to look at some of the local stories that went under the radar. Here with me in Studio 3 are Howard Manley, executive editor of the Bay State Banner, and journalist Marcella Garcia. Welcome back, you two.
Thank you for having us.
Hey, Callie.
I'm going to jump right off the top with you, Marcella. This is a story that I think that we talked about months and months ago with regard to the accidents that happen with workers who die on the job, and the statistics which indicate that many of them are immigrants.
Correct. Yeah. The construction industry has a large representation of Latino workers. Latino, and by Latino, I mean Brazilians, too, because this, of course, as you know, Massachusetts is an area where a lot of Brazilians live, and they mostly work in construction. Of course, being immigrants, they sometimes don't know the regulations or the safety equipment that they have to have and all the rules that they have to follow. So the statistics, like you say, are pretty... They tell the whole story, really. 25% of workers who died in Massachusetts last year were immigrants. So there's this organization, the Center for Brazilian Immigrants. It's a great nonprofit organization, and they conduct workshops to educate Latino workers. And by the way, these are workshops in Spanish and Portuguese to educate the workers in all these topics, and they partner with the agency, the federal agency. I'm blanking on the name right now. The federal agency of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, correct, to help, you know, provide the training. And again, these are hard to reach populations, so it's great that this center has this partnership with OSHA to provide the training needed in the language of the workers.
Yeah, one of the cases was a guy who was 63 who fell 20 feet while repairing a light when his work truck was struck by a tractor trailer. So it looks like there was, you know, a couple of elements to that injury. But it makes me wonder, you know, how much workers know in general about what safety, because... You know, if I was up on a big ladder, I mean, I know there's some things that you must have in place just to even go up on a big ladder. And then what keeps you safe after that, I wouldn't know. So what are they teaching them in these workshops? Do you have any sense of exactly, is it just the rules or are they, you know, demonstrating?
No, safety. Yeah. Demonstrating what they need to do. Because then again, a lot of these workers approach, and this is maybe cultural, they approach the work as very natural, not something technical, because they probably have 2-3 jobs, and in construction they make good money, but they approach it in a very natural, organic way. They don't really know that they have to follow this, because you don't do it in your home country. They don't teach you that. You don't go to school to do that. It's an occupation that you just learn on the job in Latin American countries. So yes, a safety, like the harnesses that you need to use, or other regulations that you need to follow. If you have to be, you know, I don't know, high in how many floors, you have to do this, and this. The equipment too, the helmets. So it is, it's absolutely going to save their lives at some point.
The thing that just strikes me about worker safety is some of that comes down to personal responsibility. When you have a guy working 2 or 3 or 4 jobs, and this guy wasn't a immigrant, but the T driver that just was working all those hours, and he falls asleep or whatever he did, and he crashes into the thing, and God bless it. It wasn't a more tragic situation, but I mean, there's other things which I think a lot of folks don't know and need to be abreast of, and particularly employers who are willing to just hire anyone at these little unsafe jobs that they may not even have licenses for, you know? So I don't know what all the odds are.
No, so and sometimes the employers assume that their workers are knowledgeable in this field. But then again, like I said...
Because they probably have some experience doing the job.
Correct.
So they just assume they know.
Assume that they know the safety procedures that need to be in place, but... It's not a safe assumption to make.
Well, 25% is a large percentage of workers to be, you know, dying on the job. That's a big number. So that's going to have to be addressed because I can see that has nowhere to go but down.
Right.
If it's already this high, so something has to happen. So that's an important story. Over to you, Howard. One United Bank.
Oh.
Receiving a Treasury Service Award. This is and a lot of money that went with this award.
Well, that's just it. I mean, this is it's the U.S. Treasury Department. They have a program that has, I guess, rigorous requirements to award a bank for its history on commercial and community lending in distressed neighborhoods. And One United, and one of the reasons why they're founded, was to sort of help those neighborhoods with capital, with loans. And I think for those guys who've been under, the media has not been kind to One United over the years. Some of it deserve it, some of it not. But they have been in the community. They have made loans, and the U.S. Treasury Department has recognized them as one of the best in the country. And to get nearly a $500,000.
Yeah, $1,000, that's amazing.
And that money goes back into the pot to make further reinvestment. So One United, even though they're in distressed neighborhoods and the risks are greater to their money actually being lent out, they're still willing to do that, and that's a good thing.
Well, there's a couple of things that should be noted with One United. Because first, why don't you remind people, you know, what One United is? I can say that I know that it's the largest African-American-owned bank in the country, and it's based here in Boston.
Based here in Boston with assets of about $500 million. It started as a combination of first the Bank of Commerce, and then it through mergers and acquisitions in Miami and then Los Angeles. They've grown to be, again, it's not as sizable as Bank of America, but it is in the communities and making the loans to institutions such as churches and other folks to get money to build projects and develop that very neighborhoods that they are willing to be in. They were not involved. And see, here's the thing. You're making these high-risk loans, but that's your community and you have to serve it. So if you don't, you still have standards. You got to be able to pay that loan back. I mean, that's how the bank has to work. I mean, it just doesn't, we just can't, the bank is not in a position just to hand out money for free. I mean, they got to get it back. So
it's worth noting, though, I was interested to learn that this is the 10th year that they've received it annual. So 10 years, for 10 years straight, they have been recognized. So that means something.
Oh, yeah. And it's not just here in Boston. It's down in Miami. It's in Los Angeles. And they're dedicated to it. I mean, that's why they, one of their branches is in Grove Hall, which is a neighborhood which they've had a long-term investment. And at one point, this is where the takeaway is that these neighborhoods were just rampant with crime and all sorts of activities. But once you start putting capital in, start doing smart development, you have a place that you have a grocery store, you have all kinds of service organizations, and it's a good thing for communities. It makes people want to live there. It increases their value. It just all starts with that bank making that loan.
I think it's also worth noting that banks like, and there's not that many anymore, but like One United Bank, were the forerunners into these communities for banking services, period, and took that those institutions to be there before larger banks like the Bank of America or whomever came in behind to put branches in there. But that had been a longstanding complaint among folks of color that, you know, banking institutions were not readily available for them. And so when banks like One United Bank went into those communities, that was very important. We should also say, because you alluded to it, but if people are trying to search their memory saying, where have I heard that before? That's in connection to the Charles Street church controversy.
And that's a big thing, right, in Grove Hall. And this is, again, it's more sad than it is anything else. But here you have the bank recognized by the U.S. Treasury Department for doing community lending. And so they partner up with the Charles Street AME Church to redevelop some property that the church owned in and around the Grove Hall area. And not only could the church not repay the nearly $5 million in loans, they've taken them to court and filed for bankruptcy. So all of this becomes and is aired out publicly. And then you start looking at what's going around the country with churches and loans. And this is not an isolated case. Out in Los Angeles, for example, the pastor out there borrowed a whole bunch of money and you don't know what happened to it. And so this lack of transparency on the church's part in these particular cases is not on the that's not One United's fault. They did everything that they were supposed to do short of paying the loan back themselves. So And the tragedy is that Grove Hall is now missing an a nice little piece of land that could have been developed. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't have, it's just another vacant building. So that's the tragedy.
I am speaking with Howard Manley. You just heard him, executive editor of the Bay State Banner, and journalist Marcella Garcia. And we are going over the local stories that went under the radar because it's Friday, and that's what we do here on Boston Public Radio. Marcella, this is a story that definitely is under the radar, and I'm just delighted to be able to talk about it with you, and that is the park named for Frida Garcia.
Yes.
Because a lot of people don't know who
Marcia,
she is and
who Frida is
and how much she has given back to this community.
Yeah, I remember, as a Latino, when you first start working with the Latino community here in Boston, that's one of the top three names that you hear immediately. She's one of the founders of La Alianza Hispana, who's the oldest multi-service agency here in Boston for Latinos. And not only that, she's done a lot of advocacy work for on behalf of Latinos, mainly in the South End. And this is long due. She's just an amazing character, someone with a lot of passion and commitment to the Latino community here in Boston. And to have a park named after her, there was this story in the Globe about this column about how
Yvonne Abraham's column.
Yvonne right. Abraham, yeah. Mm-hmm. How she was just so detached and she didn't want to do anything with the spotlight, but that's just who she is. And it's unfortunate, though, that the actual park dedication has been postponed because Mayor Menino has been in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Now he's in rehab, but he obviously wanted to be there, and so it's been postponed until the spring, I believe, mm-hmm. twice. But it's ready, it's there, and it's just a great tribute to a great woman.
I mean, what struck me in that column by Yvonne Abraham in the Boston Globe was just how generous she was of her time, mm-hmm. and how she wanted to share the limelight with other folks. And
right,
she couldn't
right.
wait to take folks past the Harriet Tubman mm-hmm. part,
the other part,
and say how this got named. And these are all her sort of her soul sisters and mm-hmm. brothers in the community activist front. So
she's also very good mentoring people and younger Latinos and Latinas. And she's married to State Representative Byron Rushing.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and so they're always very involved in the community. But she's really good mentoring and taking people under her wing.
I think a lot of people know her affiliated with Harriet Tubman House, where she worked for many, many, many years.
And she's been in numerous boards.
Seven boards.
I don't know how she does it.
It's
just unbelievable.
Again, served on a judicial nominating committee for Governor Michael Dukakis. I mean, she has just done it all.
Right.
And
right.
I think if people haven't seen her, you know, she's that sort of interesting looking woman, usually wearing a turban. With gorgeous jewelry and some fabulous glasses.
And her hair, when she's not wearing the turban, she has this black and then really silver spot.
Exactly.
She's
very striking to see, and she's always out and about doing this work.
Right.
So I think, you know, she's ubiquitous in the city in terms
great
of her
character.
Of her
and
involvement.
Before social media, she was this
exactly.
way. I mean, she was huge. I mean, just everyone knew who she is.
Yeah, totally.
And then, you know, by your work shall you be known. That's what the Bible says. So there you go.
Go on, preacher.
And by the way, it's going to be the Frida Garcia's Children's Park at Clarendon and Stanhope Streets. So we'll look forward to that in the South End when that happens. So, you know, I love some good news about somebody who's just worked quietly and finally gets their due. All right. So here we are looking for schools, Boston schools, needing solutions to combat inequality. You got a huge analysis piece in the Banner, Howard Manley, just really deconstructing some of these plans and what the issues are and talking about the Circle of Promise, which is an area in Roxbury and Dorchester and Jamaica Plain in the South End, and what needs to happen there to put the Boston City Schools back in balance from an equitable standpoint.
Yeah, real good story by Ken Cooper, who's been around Boston and public education for decades. And he's looked at what he calls the circle of, a circle. And it includes in that circle most of the underperforming schools in the Boston public school system. And so one of the points, and this comes in the context of these busing and class assignment meetings and trying to get those updated is that a lot of time is wasted. I mean, right now there are five different class assignment plans. And within just this circle, under these five plans, they would be in 23 different zones. So the one thing, and it's almost like redistricting, we need to simplify. And this is one of the points that Cooper makes. It has to be simplified such that it's not as confusing as it's made out to be. And there's no way you can wade through all of those plans and all these districts and all these schools and all these variables and come up with a system that works because you spend too much time in bureaucracy. So one of the things that Cooper wants is, A, as a goal, is to make all the schools better. And how do you do that? Well, you have to sort of get more incentives for the better teachers and the better principals to administrate, get them trained up, get them inspired, get them in all that, and get the students and the parents involved. So all this stuff works. It's new theory, but it all comes down to having a neighborhood throughout the city and each neighborhood supporting each of those schools, whether they're K through 8 or high school, and making it all of them have the same standards and making the same test scores and improving the entire city's young people's minds through public education.
One of the things that I thought is interesting about this, Marcella, is that originally one of the drivers of trying to revisit this whole system, which is admittedly a little bit tangled up, was to try to move away from busing and toward neighborhood schools. But in the piece that Ken has written for the Bay State Banner, he makes it clear that it's going to be very tough, and this is a quote from Carol Johnson, the superintendent, to eliminate it entirely, or otherwise you'll end up with the same kind of division where you have the, quote, circle of promise area where these schools are underperforming, and they're all, the kids are crunched in one area, and they don't have the same kind of resources or opportunities, and in other parts of the city they do, so which was the original reason for busing.
It's a complex issue, and it has many, many levels. And when you talk about underperforming schools, you and in this reassignment debate, you have to look at the composition of the school student body, like all the students. We have 43% Latino students. It's 43% white students are a minority. And I think that in and of itself should play more of a role in this debate. Anything that has to do with the Boston Public Schools needs to have this thing in consideration, because when you're talking about underperforming schools and you have this large population of the 57,000 students in Boston, you have to look at ESL, English as a Second Language, programs. Or just the other day in the New York Times, there was this huge story about how the studies on how Latino students are not seeing themselves represented in textbooks, and that, of course,
and in teacher ranks either. And,
right, that's what right. That's where I was going. So, see, that's
so
a
that
huge
impacts
one right
their
right.
their learning. Of right. course, right. They don't respond better. They would respond better to learning if they would see themselves. And they would connect to the things that they see in textbooks better. So all this, I mean, I know it's a very multifaceted issue, very complex, but you have to look at all these things.
And incorporate them into the curriculum. We had another story, and this goes for some elementary schools, where senior citizens are going back to the schools and teaching kids how to read and spending that little 20-minute, 30-minute quality time getting the kids to sort of focus on, and it's nice because these are volunteers. I mean, you get a couple little some money for transportation and all, but they're spending that extra time, and some of this is time spent. If you're worried about, you know, whether your bus is going to get to school on time and all the traffic, and then going from one class to another, all of that just keeps kids out of focus, and so. It's everything. It's almost like the Boston Public Schools, as most school districts across the country, they're not in a position to turn down any idea, really, to improve and close these achievement gaps. And it's not that even around the world, it's the U.S. school system is not number one. It's in the top 20. Woo-hoo. Yeah. So a lot of it starts right here on the ground in communities like Roxbury, Dorchester and Mattapan, Jamaica Plain, where you get the kids that everyone says are not able to learn. And then, but it's not true. You got some charter schools doing very well.
Exactly.
And because they spend the time, they look at the whole kid, and they're not worried about all these other side issues about how they're getting to school and all. So, and it's a lot of inordinate amount of money spent on that as opposed to classroom time.
Well, and I also want to just, you know, if I could elaborate on, you know, something that both of you said with regard to Latino teachers or and the lack thereof in the ranks. And, you know, people could hear this and say, well, look, there's some good teachers no matter what their color, and they can connect with kids. Nobody's denying that. That's absolutely true. But when you have a large segment of the population and there are no, and we're talking about, I think you could probably count on one hand how many Latino teachers there are.
Yeah.
The
numbers have
really
gone down.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We're not in a position to turn down any idea. And I think a lot of kids relate just culturally, which is a one big block. If you don't feel comfortable, you look at the textbooks and you don't see anybody, I have to err on the side of, yeah, let's get some more Latino teachers, let's get some more Black teachers, let's get old folks in there, let's get everybody in there to start putting hands on. Because you never know what's going to unlock that key to a child's mind.
Well, just to, and this is another story you have, is there any possibility that part of this solution that we're talking about here with this partner's donation of $1 million to Boston Public Schools will do something?
Yes, this is a new initiative where Partners Healthcare, and there are two hospitals. I always remember Brigham's, and I don't remember the other hospital.
Mass General.
Yeah, Mass MGA, General. That's exactly right. Are putting in $1 million for emotional and social skill development in Boston Public Schools. And so they're going to train teachers. They're going to have these classes, and they're going to be system-wide to just deal with the emotional skill set that young minds have. And it's a 20-minute class twice a week. It's being run out of this Wellesley College.
Yay,
teachers.
Wellesley.
Yeah, well, they're on the ground on this one, and
as always.
And they look at what they have found so far in preliminary research is that the grades and test scores go up by 10-15% based on a kid being able to sort of handle. All of those things we as adults need an occasional fresher up course on, you know, and just in how to communicate, how to deal with confrontation, how to disagree without being disagreeable. And so once again, you want to remove as many obstacles in every individual child's head that you have. And one of them is this program. And it's a 2-year program.
Which
they have another grant at the back end of this to study the results of this. And so anything that looks at the entire child, as opposed to, and Carol Johnson is quoted in this as saying that, you know, any innovative idea, the school systems is not in a position to say no to anything that has half a chance of working.
Especially on emotional intelligence, something that invests in emotional intelligence so early on. You can call it like therapy for kids or something, but they need to be in that environment to be able to
just
talk
how to
about
channel
socially.
That.
Yeah.
Just how do you do it? They do a lot of role playing. They do a lot of skits. And it's very hands on and very now and in your face. So how do you do this when you want to study I think a wave that's going to go on in the future.
Marcella, I just want to point out that the piece, just in case people are saying, "Oh, for God's sake, this new age stuff," I need to highlight the bottom lineness of this.
Yeah.
On average, there's a gain of 11 percentile points in reading and math, hardly new agey, as a result of this kind of work with students. So this is 2 years
relevant,
of this from a significant partners grant for $1 million to Boston Public Schools can make a huge difference, and particularly in these affected populations.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. I am speaking with Marcella Garcia, who is a journalist, and Howard Manley, executive editor of the Bay State Banner, and we are going over local news that went under the radar. This is one that is, I hope, way under the radar, Marcella, but I'm a little concerned. The Mayan calendar is saying it's over for us. I know my Edgar was talking about it from the star perspective, from the space perspective, but down here on the ground, the Mayans for centuries have predicted this on the calendar.
Yeah, but you got to look at what's behind, though. Everyone outside the academia is saying that this is going to happen just based on the fact that the Mayans stopped their calendar on December 21st, 2012. But that doesn't mean that the world is going to end. Everybody is interpreting it like that, but the academia is not. So locally, a scholar at Harvard of Mexican descent actually teamed up with his daughter to write a book, and for a children's book, actually, to educate kids on this. And because obviously kids start hearing this in the media and the world is going to end. And we had that story last week on Russia, like the whole country literally believing that the world was going to end, which is ridiculous. But apparently they were believing that. So it's a very cool way to educate kids and demystify the whole Mayan thing. And again, it's this professor who has studied not only the Mayans, but Aztecs, cultures, from very, very different perspectives. And for a long time, David Carrasco, he categorically says that it's not true. And the apocalypse is, I mean, he talks about how this is a topic that comes up in every religion, you know, at any given time. And people, it is just because it's human nature that people just want to, you know, feel that kind of fear. I don't know, but he says it's pretty natural to expect the apocalypse.
Well, I just want to point this out, though, Marcella, just for those of us who might be a little nervous. I mean, you know, this is not something they sent in a text. They wrote this. They engraved this.
They engraved it, but did not say that it was going to end.
Interpretation. It's interpretation. Back in the green room with the astronomy and my guy, who's the senior editor at the Sky and Telescope magazine, tells me that the Mayans had a system of calendars that, like, we have ours of, like,
yes,
months,
correct,
days,
correct,
and years, and
they
then
measure
maybe
it differently.
Centuries. Mm-hmm. And so their longest measurement was what we would consider 5,100 years. So the 5,100 years, it started at 3,600 B.C., and then it comes up to 2,000 right now.
Howard, we're so glad you listened to Andrew's interview with Kelly Beattie.
So here's the bottom line on it. It's just that they have to hit the reset button.
Yeah, exactly.
They ran out of calendar space. It's like Y2K.
Exactly.
I am up on this.
It's an interpretation issue.
I just wanted to speak about the fact that if the Latinos had engraved it, what are we talking about? You know, he's looking at some stuff from out in space. I'm talking about what was engraved. That's all. All right, now that we've cleared that up.
All right. The world is not ending.
The world is not ending, but we are ending this segment right now. Thank you both for talking to us about local news that went under the radar. I've been talking about local news under the radar with Howard Manley, executive editor of the Bay State Banner, and journalist Marcella Garcia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Callie.
Jazz pianist Dave Brubeck died earlier this week. This track, Take Five, is one that most people know and have probably heard a lot this week. Boston's Dean of Jazz, Eric Jackson, is going to be here in the studio with us to take us beyond Take Five, beyond the Brubeck most of us know by way of a 1999 concert. I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio.